Many of you know Zen stories. They always have some humor, but are full of the Dharma, full of messages to help us understand ourselves and our lives a little more, and hopefully bring some of this message into your practice, into your daily life. So this story goes that there was a young fellow who was brought to the temple. He was a simple fellow, and his family thought perhaps the monk in the temple could help him develop, help him achieve some small interest in life, learn a few practical things in daily life, which to this stage he had not really acquired. And this fellow comes, and the master spends a lot of time with him. He tries to teach him some simple stories, such as the story of the Buddha. He tries to show him how to do a few simple activities. However, the concentration of this young boy was not so developed. So whatever seemed to be taught was not grasped easily and was not put into practice. So the master was a little concerned, and he thought, well, how can I help this boy? And he decides to teach him how to make a fire. One of the daily activities in temples in Korea, especially in winter, is putting a fire under the floor so the floors are hot. And one of the temples I stayed in, I had to make about 6 fires under various floors. It was my job. So I have quite a great empathy for this young man learning to make fires. However, he was more amused in playing with the matches or playing with the sticks. But as time went on, he did achieve to make a fire. And he would watch the fire as it burnt, because they burn for about an hour and that will heat the floor for a day. And then he started to chop a little bit of wood and carry the wood. But still, he was very distracted. A fire could take him half a day, nearly a whole day to make. Then one day he was curious. You know, so many people came to visit this master, and the master would sit and talk. And he thought, oh, I wonder what he tells them. What is this Buddha? What is this teaching all about? And he goes past the master's room, and he hears the master saying, talking about the Buddha as being Shin, which is like the mind. But in his simple language, Shin means shoe. And he couldn't understand why his wonderful beloved teacher was calling the Buddha a shoe. And this became a parable for him. It became a quandary. He would look at his rustic straw sandals and think, is this a Buddha? He would look at sandals in front of the room and say, how can this be a Buddha? And life went on. But the master started to notice his engagement in making a fire was becoming quite skillful. His curiosity about the fire and how wood burned to create heat started to take on an actual inquiry, an actual perception of interest. He started to chop wood with more skill. He packed his backpack. We used to have what is called a jigi, a backpack that would carry the wood. He packed this really well. He could carry a bigger load. And he was noticing the odd thing, this fellow was getting sharper. He didn't talk very much, but he seemed to be holding in his mind this quandary about how a Buddha is a shoe. And one day when he had filled his backpack full of wood and he was carrying it to the fireplace, he tripped over a rock, and the shoe, his straw sandal, flew in the air and hit him on the head. And in this moment, he had a profound insight, a profound understanding. And he was so humbled by this understanding, he fell to the ground, kissed his shoes, hugged his shoes, and he put his shoes on his head, and he went to his teacher, bowed to his teacher, offered his shoes to his teacher, and he said, "Who would ever know? How could anybody ever know that these dirty old shoes are a Buddha?" And of course, his teacher had no idea what this simple fellow was talking and thought he was completely crazy, you know. It's an interesting parable because it has many deep insights in it. I mean, in many ways, we are a little like this fellow, often stumbling in our lives in some aspect, bewildered and confused by some of the depth of the Dharma, some of our teachings that we cannot really understand, you know. We hear Buddhist teachings all the time, and we use what is easily understood or what seems to work, and other deeper, more profound things do not work. And when you think of the concept of Buddha, it's a very profound concept, you know. It is so profound, none of us, or very few of us, have had a full realization, such as the Arahant or the great teachers of the past. When we go about our daily lives, we are so absorbed with our desires, our attachments, our interests. This young fellow would have been very absorbed in his food and certain parts of his living, probably loved the birds flying past, and absorbed in the little insects that jump here and there, absorbed in the flames and the fire. Our attraction to our senses, our sensual realm, is a very powerful. Sometimes when we get very weighed by all that we have in our life, we develop through the attachment also anger or jealousies, ill will, when things do not arise in the way we want them to. And I'm sure, you know, in the same, this fellow in his simplicity still would have had agitations, frustrations. He would have looked at the world and wondered what on earth is really being shared here and spoken about, as he thought when he saw his teacher teaching other people, and all he could understand was a Buddha is a shoe. All he heard was the Buddha is a shoe. Sometimes when our minds are a little bit scattered and confused and simple and overburdened, we become a little lazy. We feel tired in life. Sloth takes over. For some of us, you know, all these things are impounding on us all the time. That's often what brings us into wanting to do meditation, to bring more clarity, more energy. And to actually pacify some of the restlessness that arises in our life. However, weather? This question he had created what we would call a great doubt. There is skeptical doubt, which is the fifth of the hindrances. But rather than skeptical doubt for this young man, it was what is called a great doubt. In Zen we say you need great faith, great inquiry, which is great doubt, and great effort to practice. And gradually this fellow started to develop through his great doubt about what is shared between a Buddha and a shoe. That all the little minor confusion started to fall away. Whatever had made him not comprehend in life simple things started to make his mind much clearer, made his eyes clearer, his ears clearer. His taste and touch would have been sharper. So when he looked into the flames of a fire, he would have been burning some of these confused passions, confused developments of his mind. And so his mind would have been much brighter, much in the moment, much more in the moment, less in skeptical doubt and more in the great doubt. And then when this moment of touch happens, it would be a sound, and touch and singular thought, his whole being is penetrated in this moment into a place they call the great emptiness, the great disillusionment of all that we know as it is dissolved. And great freedom arises, great sense of openness and trust and love arises from this. I know when I was a novice, you know, there were so many things that were very new to me. I didn't know the language. The food was very spicy, very salty, so each taste always seemed to be so different. And the people's actions were very different. They were very fast in Korea. The monks and nuns sort of run. And people would talk at me and I had no idea what I was supposed to be doing. So in many ways I was very much like this fellow. And slowly, by listening to the Dhamma and meditating and cleansing my mind through prayer, prostrations, but in particular living in community, you know, living with other monks and nuns, my heart and mind settled and started to find the daily life and the daily practices extremely beneficial. There's a saying in Korea, the practice of monks and nuns is like putting potatoes in a bucket, shaking the potatoes, shaking the bucket like this, and the potatoes rub against each other and they remove the skin and round the rough edges off. So we become, you know, all a little bit similar in some ways, and our hearts and our strong hindrances sort of fall away. But there is another quite interesting teaching that's fairly unique in the Chinese Buddhism. I'm not sure if there is a comparison in Theravada, but there would be in some level. And it is a teaching about the host and the guest. You know, this young boy comes to a temple, he is like a guest. And the host is the really in the temple of the hostess, the temple itself, and anyone coming into it a really guest. But in this case, the master is the host. In our own mind, it is a school of thought, and it is a whole training about how to train the mind, the senses, and the sense attachments to their objects, the sight and its attachment to shape and colour and form are the guest, you know. They come in to as a sight touches its object, you know, moment of consciousness, the sight consciousness, it burns its object, it devours its object. And then it's assimilated through thought processing, the consciousness of thought, to become either something we are attracted to, attached to, or something that is let go. The same in all our senses of hearing and seeing and tasting and touch. These are things that arise through conditions, through our attachments, through our interest, through our inquiry. They either develop into a function, develop into something that we then grasp, put into use, or they fall away quickly. You know, as consciousness arises, about the sixth level, it starts to label, become labels through preconditioned knowing. And then we start to see how useful this is. All done in a split second. Many arising and passing away in a moment. So these are all like the visitors to our home. What happens when the guest starts to take over in a home? You invite all your guests in and say, well, welcome, stay as long as you like. What will soon happen? Soon what the home has to offer will dissolve, will disappear. So when we put too much through into our mind, through our sense doors, what happens? We start to have an erosion of mind. The mind starts to become very confused. The host starts to get very unhappy. Or the host leaves. Sometimes, you know, all the guests take over and there's no one home. So in the host and the guest teachings, we need to know what it is that's the guest that is coming in and out, and who is the host? What is this fundamental pure existence that is always present? The only unconditioned thing. What is this very pure state of mind that can allow everything to come and go? It's because we don't understand this relationship. We have not seen the purity of our capacity and the capacity of our heart, our mind, that we have invited the guests in so freely. So through meditation we start to see, okay, what is a useful perceptions? What is it I need to view? What is useful sound? You know, endless gossip and endless harsh speech only agitates our thoughts. What are useful thoughts? Such as taste, touch. What is useful in these things? And how much is too much? How do they arise? Where do they arise from? If you take one sense organ as a practice, such as we are doing the practice of breath, it is a tool that allows us to connect to sensation or movement or thought. It's just a tool. If you sit and look at a candle, the light of a candle, it becomes a tool to understand, you know, the perception, the consciousness of perception. But if we take one of these very useful objects of concentration and we develop our awareness on this, then we start to see very clearly who in this moment is the guest and who is the host. Where something arises, how it arises, when it passes away, how it passes away, and what is left when things are left to rest. In Zen training, this is very important. We are trained to actually act as if the external world, the objects we use in our life, are no other than myself. When I hold something, I hold this tissue. In this moment, this tissue is an extension of me. Why? Because the object of touch only exists because of the capacity in this body to feel, to sense through feeling. Just as the object of seeing can only exist because of the faculty of eye and the consciousness which arises in relationship to the seeing. But then what is the problem here? There's not a problem so much with pure seeing and pure experience. But what does become a problem is our attachment or rejection or unuseful use of these senses and their objects. So the Buddha taught us, once we understand clearly what is arising and passing, how it is arising and passing, and what it is we hold in our mind, then we actually will benefit not only ourselves but others, everyone in our life. Because what happens? We become more caring about what it is we touch, what we bring into our life. We become more careful about the guests we invite in, and we become a better host. Problems are not so much related to, you know, unpleasant things arising for us. It is not really a problem. These are a wonderful opportunity for us to practice if we do not have the defilements or the ignorance. We do not have the dislikes or the emotions, the fear, the anger arising. It becomes very difficult to practice. It's a much more subtler level of practice. So when these ordinary everyday emotions arising from our relationship through the senses and the sense doors, then we have a great opportunity to work with these and understand what is going on here clearly. So going back to the story, as this young fellow was developing, through concentrating, he used this tool, this question, to concentrate his mind. In Korea, we use what is called a hwadu. Hwadu means it's the core of a Zen tale, the core of a koan. It's the basic story, the essence of the story, you know, the who am I, the what is this, the whys in a story. Now, you may have your own story, but if you held on to one story and you hold on to that essence, you'll find a lot of unnecessary things start to fall away in your life. There's a wonderful story which I was sharing with the nuns the other day, a true story of a woman in Korea. And a master told me this story. And it was a woman who, you know, as mothers and wives and other family members do, have a lot of problems in her life, you know. The husband had other affairs, and the children were misbehaving, and she was losing, you know, really losing a sense of family here. And very distracted about everything, very disturbed. And she comes to the master and she's always complaining. This person's doing this and that person's doing that. And he sat and listened, and then at the end he said, I'll give you one teaching. I'll give you one thing. It doesn't matter. Never mind, it doesn't matter. He said, hold this. Just hold this one phrase. Whatever happens, never mind. It's an interesting word, never and mind. It doesn't matter. And so she goes home and she's holding this practice. First it was a little hard, you know, she still got distracted and got angry with the husband or the children. But then slowly, you know, she started to notice they were doing whatever anyway. So it became, doesn't matter, never mind. And little by little, the husband started not going out so much and being home and taking a little more responsibility. And the children were getting brighter at school and more interested in their homework. And she was continuing on with this practice. Whatever you do, it doesn't matter. Do it because you like it, don't do it because you don't like it. And she held this practice. One day a neighbor came and said, oh, your child's fallen in the pond. Never mind. Your husband's crashed the car. Never mind. No great disasters came. And then one day she was frying pancakes, threw the oil in the fry pan, and as the oil spattered up, her mind in this moment was purified. And she had again used this tool as the young simple fellow and had cleared her mind, purified her mind, observed what was necessary in her capacity to do, became very mindful of her daily actions, mindful of her responsibilities, and allowed others their space to become mindful of theirs, trusted. Trust developed without even trying. Friendship developed without even trying. Love developed. Compassion developed. Where the mind became still and not overly interfering all the time. So in a similar way, this young fellow, you know, started to do things in a sensible way, cut and stack wood in a proper way, make a fire in a proper way, start to see himself as the fire, as the wood, as the earth he walked on, as the air he breathed. This is the practice. Monastic practice is quite simple, actually. We are given out of the great benefit of your generosity, the capacity to simplify our lives. See, the time to take a meal as a very precious opportunity to practice each mouthful, each taste, allows us the opportunity to experience fully what is happening through the sense of taste, through the sense of smell, through the sense of hearing. Once I was sitting in a forest and I was doing this counting of breath, and the counting disappeared. I was just breathing deeply, you know, it was just one that became part of the air, one, a sound and breath, a sound and breath. And this big wind came, and it was just part of this sound that just went on and on and on and on. In a moment, it's a very long time. You know, another moment that adds to a moment, adds to a moment, adds to a moment. It may have been a very short time, but in the appearance outside of time, things can seem to expand or exist forever. It's a very, very long time. So as our moments can become a little bit fuller, freer, more open, we become generous. We want to give of ourselves. It's a natural response. You know, human beings are naturally open, generous, kind beings. Babies are naturally open, generous. They don't think I'm generous. They are just totally giving in this moment. But little by little, our perceptions and ideas and attachment to these things create many walls in our life, many boundaries that we become very confined by. So we use this opportunity to come to a place like this, to listen to Dharma talks from monastic of all tradition. You're very obviously very grounded in Theravada practices. You have wonderful teachers like Achyam Brahm, Sister Vyama. So you're very grounded in all the truth the Buddha had to share. But are we bringing this into our life? Are we really looking into this practice as if it is our life, as if it is the last breath? If so, then in this moment we are complete. We are fulfilled. If death comes, it is only another moment of life. You don't have life without death. You don't have the front of the hand without the back. You don't have an in-breath without an out-breath. Mind you, you may not have another in-breath. But once you've had that in-breath, you have your out-breath. So there is that opportunity with every in-breath to live that fully. There was once a woman in an iron chamber, and when asked how she could bear to just be constantly confined in this way, she said, "When they open the window and the breath just passes across my cheek, I am so happy to be alive and to be here." Gosh, you know, how often do we experience it in that intensity? Every moment is a great opportunity to hear, to see, and a great opportunity for us to share this very short time together. So I think it is time that if you have a question, something that you would like to ask or like to share, please. Be free. I can, if no one's going to talk, I can give you one other little story. It's a slight flip side of the one we've just had. This one's a Japanese one. And this is also about a simple fellow taken to a temple. And his parents, in trying, because Japan is a very tight society, very, you know, closed society, so to have a child born not quite so perfect can sometimes be an embarrassment in some parts of society. And so they have this fellow, and after a very short time they realized they could not train or teach this young boy, so they take him to a temple. But in the meantime, out of their embarrassment, the couple go off to the woods to practice, off to the forest. And this monk spends his life. He does what he can, everything he can. And every time he turns around, this young boy has got his handful of biscuits or crackers, chomping on them with a big smile on his face. The monk holds his hand and shows him how to sweep, and holds him his hand and shows him how to polish. But then goes the hand towards the crackers, fills his mouth. His eyes only see food. And as the monk gets older, he's starting to worry, who's going to look after my temple? And who's going to look after this poor fellow? Who's going to love him as I've loved him? Dress him and wash him. And he's lying on his deathbed and he's thinking, my goodness, what is going to become of you? And at that moment, with his hands full of crackers, he stuffs them in his mouth and chomp! And the old monk, his worries fall away and he dies with a big smile on his face. And as the story goes, that throughout his life he illuminated not only his parents, but many people, the old monk and many other people who came into his life. So the basic moral of the story is we never know who comes into our life, who can be in their rather unforgiving, perhaps unpleasant nature, can be our greatest inspiration, our greatest enlightening factor. So some of those people who may be of annoyance, who may be problematic, who may appear as if they are petty tyrants, in fact may be the very thing we are needing to help our practice go along. So I'm sure someone has a question. The Buddha said, if you have no questions, then the future is looking very dim. It may sound a little different. The Zen style of speaking is a little different, yes. Sometimes we can be more analytical. Sometimes we share through stories and experiences. It's a practical tradition. We learn to do things in a very practical way. We see life and action as not separate. Each action is complete in itself. And each existence arises anew all the time. Yes?
Now, I'd just like to ask for people like myself who are here and we live every day and we've got the world to deal with. I almost feel like every day I'm just sort of winding, wound up. My whole mind is sort of wound up and sped up, and then I'm trying to unwind it again. Winding up, unwinding up. I feel like I'm not really coming anywhere.
Yeah. Sounds like an old clock. I mean, I think in life we have to start to, as you start to practice, some of your choices for action become a little clearer, so they're not so habituated. It's like, as I mentioned in the breath, you know, you might look at the whole length or the cycle or some aspect of it, but actually when you come back to it, it's not so much as a beginning or an end, it's a process of many experiences. And some of them we do, you know, in a very smooth way. They seem to come to us easy and we fulfill that, you know, job quite easily. And others are quite a challenge. And that is in all aspects of our life. Because our life and our relationships within our life, I mean, other human relationships or relation, family or friends and so forth, or colleagues, is one aspect. But the material is another aspect. Time is another aspect. All these aspects in our life, we need to develop some sort of equanimity that engage them in a way they are bringing more harmony and more peace into our life. Now, if our attachments to our loved ones are very, very strong on one level, and we are really challenged on another level to meet the material needs of, you know, our family existence, then sometimes there becomes many problems in our life. And we see, you know, we see things in a very scattered way, you know, or a very detached way. But actually they're not. They are all a part of who you are. And the practice of meditation is to make you see yourself as a whole unit. And all these things are not going on as if they're separate out there. They're not something that's manifested outside of your control. There's something that you have actually made choices to create and engage in. So whenever we make a choice to do something, I make a choice to go from here outside, there is a means to go from here to there. And I develop the skills to do all these things in my life. If you have too much, and I find in people's lives now, the sense, young people, their sense experience is just phenomenal. Sometimes it's too much. So they're wound up. By the time they go to bed, you know, they're so wound up with so many impressions and so many experiences in the day that they never rest. And they feel driven by those experiences and those impressions. They say that an 8-year-old girl experiences, more new things than her 80-year-old mother has lived in a lifetime. It's amazing. She somehow is introduced to so much in a very short time. So we have to be a little bit careful how much we want to bring into our life. And my personal experience is, how much can I get rid of it? How much can I simplify it? Is the message to actually making me a little bit happier. Now that doesn't mean necessarily getting rid of all your material things, but it can mean that you can shed some of the responsibility of holding on, or some of the attachment to, you know, what it is you have. Because it's really only because we really think this is very real, very important. It's mine, you know, the I sense here, the grasping here is what is making the main problem. So the more we see that these are things that have come into our life, because if you can sit down and work out the conditions for it and recognize those conditions, and you can start to clarify your mind to think, well, you know, I only have this many hours in the day, you know, how am I going to share it amongst all of my existence? What is really important here? Sometimes we're very willing to have all the new things all the time, something new, some new experience. We go to a different restaurant every night, watch a different movie every night. This input is massive on your high. You can take a lot of it, but at some point you can't take much more. Because are you really experiencing it then? Or are you just, you know, it's just you know, this mass of sensational input. So from meditation, we try to simplify it, we try to come back as much as we can to a practice that will concentrate the moment in this, the mind in this moment, so we can be completely one in this moment with some practice. And that, what that will do is that will open the mind, center it, still it, and it will bring peace there. It will bring some peace. And if a bit lucky, maybe some bliss will go with it. Some lightness, you know. They say the fire rises, and as the heat element rises, the consciousness rises, it creates this spacious, lucid, clear mind that has the quality of deep, deep inner peace. And then you come into your other activities with this state. Yeah, things become simpler. You do them differently. So it's very important that you develop some aspect of meditation. Very, very important. And you do it every day. Everyone that I've known who has started meditation, or any of my students who have come, even for a short time, I see a difference, because what they start to do is they start to feel more solid about themselves, more confident, more centered, more still, more present. And that grows. That grows more deeply on many levels. Okay. Any more questions, concerns? That's a very good question. You don't. Just to sit myself on this cushion again. Now, I mean, there's a number of questions being asked here. One is, most of the objects we see, we have already preconceived the seeing. You know, we have an idea prior seeing about what it is we are seeing. And that has come from, you know, the conditions of previous experience. As that develops in the mind, much of what we are doing in life is already preconceived. We already are working from what it is we have intention to gain out of that action. As you start to meditate more and there is less of the preconceived, less of the connection to memory so much as the idea of shape and colour. You know, that's green because I know it's green through previous experiences, or yellow, whatever. There is an object of perception, but what doesn't arise in it are all the desires or interest or intent with that object. And so the mind, it will see things arising, but when it doesn't grasp it, they just arise, you know, in multitude. They might just flow through as if, you know, it's a wind passing you. But when there's not grasping, there is a witnessing, but there is a resting of the mind in the nature of things. And that knowing is a deep knowing that you and that you are perceiving are not separate. They cannot be separate. You take away your eyes. It's not that the external world from another sensory experience doesn't exist. But for a person who passes away and the senses no longer experience life as they do now, this world does not exist in the same way to them. You can understand that, can't you? So the knowing, most of our knowing, is a very preconceived idea about our existence. So as something arises, we start to become aware of the mind that adds an idea to it, adds previous condition to it, such as judgments, adds emotion to it, such as I like or I don't like. And it may even store that information for future use. But if it rises very purely, as you may have in an experience where in meditation, when the mind in deep samadhi or deep concentration, the mind just is poised in the moment of arisal, which is what we call the state of unborn, it never actually comes to creating. In this heightened experience of meditation, it doesn't come to actually creating formations that develop attachment, name, shape, form. Well, oneness is another experience again. Yes, you can. Once perhaps the sense of I in its, you know, selfish, egoistic, attached way starts to fall away, then the sense of us, so to speak, or the sense of connection becomes very apparent. You know, so you start to see there is a deep interrelating going on all the time. You know, we can't sit in this room without the floor and the walls and everything that's supporting us to be here. There, we are connected to this floor at this particular moment in time, and this space, and all of us sitting in here. There is a connection. If only in colour, we take everything else away, colour and shape, we are connected. Because we all have an idea of red and yellow and blue and pink. Now we take away that idea, what do we see? Would you be necessarily seeing people? Not necessarily. Because this is a concept, this is an idea that we have created from our beginningless, as we say. And these, as you start to meditate and you get more clarity and space in the mind, you start to see things anew, fresh. It's like you can look at a leaf as if you've never seen a leaf before, and find great joy in that moment, because there is great joy in something that's very new to you, very fresh, where you're not caught by concepts. In meditation, early meditation retreats, I remember, you know, walking around laughing at really simple things.
So would you say that you're interacting with your visual experience of that leaf at that moment, or are you interacting with the essence of the leaf, which is the thing that's given?
Well, I think, you know, going back to your oneness, sharing oneness there, once you start to see somehow in that moment you are that leaf, you know, you're arising as that leaf is arising to you, as, you know, being present to you, then this experience is a beautiful thing, you know. I mean, you can see it as a photographer can see to some degree. A scientist can see this to some degree. A doctor working with patients empathizes with the patients to some degree, because he sees his own humanity in that moment and its limitations. It may not always be joyful, but through our deep experience of who we are, then we deeply experience life in a very beautiful and creative way. Mm. And a unique way. No two moments are ever going to be repeated here. Yes. And a very caring way. So when you do experience life in that way, you know, the ground you walk on is something you care about. The air you breathe is something you care about. Nature itself, this is the Buddha's enlightenment, was all about his connection to nature. Hmm. Yes.
I would like to ask a question.
Yes.
You were talking a story about the Nevermind story.
Mm-hmm.
After 24 years, my marriage disintegrated and my ex-wife was planning meditation for it. So it wasn't Nevermind, it was very painful experience. Tell us about Nevermind. And is it 24 years of attachment or of love, or a both or nothing?
No. Now, in this case, is never mind is a practice to, what do you say, unbind some of the complexities of attachment, in the sense where it's painful because of our delusion around our attachments. So then you have to somehow find something. It was a particular practice that worked for that person in that case. In your case, no, of course, you know, you have had so much experience and so much interconnection, so to speak, so many things you have shared, you know, possibly children, you know, all your reality together has been something that has held a lot of love and a lot of very precious moments. I mean, that they cannot be taken away, even though you may be angry or upset or have emotion that is not continuing in this moment. They have existed for you in their time. That is still within your memory. Only it's attachment. I mean, it's experience for what it is. It's attachment if you regurgitate it and manipulate it and you know, use that in some way that creates unwholesome states of mind for you now. So when we are attached to something, it is going to create some barrier to us being more open and more accepting, more understanding. This is the problem with attachment. You know, I hang on to this until I let go of it. I can't touch anything else. I have no hands to hold on to anything else. This is a very simple analogy here. So when we hang on to something very tightly, it either gets smothered through our excessive love or excessive attachment. And it often means there has not been enough understanding, enough perhaps listening or perhaps reflecting. We have held on to an idea too tightly or an ideal too tightly that in fact it dies. So when we hang on to sometimes the past, we are not able to live in this moment. We're not able to create the future that we want through our attachments. Okay. Yes. Mm. Because the idea of Shu and his idea of Buddha are in fact really a concept. You know, he had a concept. The shoe was used for a certain purpose. And even though he thought, you know, the Buddha must be something profound, there's a big gold Buddha in the shrine room, he couldn't, and he believed his teacher so profoundly, he couldn't understand why his teacher would call his dirty old shoe a Buddha. I mean, the teacher didn't say that, because shin also means like mind, a profound mind. In this language, it's just he didn't know that meaning of that word. So he held this very delusory concept in his mind. But we actually are always holding very delusory concepts in our mind. We think this is very good for us. And actually, it may not be. When you're a little bit more clearer about life, you start to see a lot of things you've been holding in your mind as being fact or as being true or as being good have not been as you've thought them to be. Even views about yourself. So he thought, you know, the concept of him as the Buddha is this gold image. So how could the Buddha be a shoe? But actually, we're not talking historical Buddha here. We're talking a state of enlightenment as Buddha. So how he came to have an understanding was when, in the moment, not only sound, but the touch, so it was touch, sound and movement, all in this one moment, with the thought. He was probably thinking, you know, how this inquiry that had already made his mind, the other thoughts had fallen away, and he just is holding this one thought, a bit like a mantra probably, this one inquiry. You know, when you're inquiring about something, a scientist trying to resolve a problem, they only have one thing on their mind until they break through that problem. So he's got this one thing on his mind, and then suddenly the shoe hits his head and breaks straight through it. Just slices through it. And of course, you know, then the shoe in this moment becomes something of profound existence, because it is the very thing. Like for the Buddha, it is when he saw the morning star and he had his great realization. For some teachers, it's when they hear a bird chirp or a tree fall or the lightning strike. Whatever it is, that in that moment the idea of any separate self or any separate existence falls away. There is just that, whatever that is. And in this case, it was the pain of the shoe on his head, or the sound of the shoe on his head. So sometimes when you're sitting in meditation, especially in Japan, where I practice for a while, you know, and you start to dream a little, you know, the next thing you're getting this big whack on your shoulders, you know, to wake you up. It is a similar sort of experience here.
So anything, in fact, can be a Buddha moment?
Anything, in fact, can be a Buddha moment. And if you read the stories, enlightened stories, of how people have come to their understanding, their deep understanding, there is a very great range. Because it's based on overcoming the illusions we have about our senses and who we think we are. So once this delusion falls away, anything that is going to make it fall away, whether it is a little bit easier through feeling and hearing than it is through seeing. And that I only say that in that perception's very fast. Seeing perception's very fast. But I heard the other day, interesting thing, that skin is an extension of the ear. We always think of an ear as an extension to our skin. So what came first was, you know, the organ of the ear with all the little hairs on it. So hearing and feeling are very closely connected. And in Zen stories, they say once the you can hear through your eyes and see through your ears. you know, or taste through your, you know, your senses, then you start to understand this body a little bit more. Some of the practices, some of the things that happen in a samadhi state, that you'll experience the body in a very different way, especially if you have samadhi while you're eating or while you're bathing. Yes. Do you want me to make you a map? Well, the fire actually is probably so where the Buddha is sitting, you know, you've got the Buddha, where the Buddha is sitting, that would be the floor level, and the ground level of the fire would be where the floor is approximately. So when they have a place where you make fires generally, either that or if it's at floor level and the house is much higher. No, you crouch, usually on your haunches crouching, because the fire goes down. And they put a fire in one temple. We didn't have a lot of wood, but we used to burn a lot of grass. So we had these sort of bamboo grass that grew in the mountains. So we'd cut the bamboo grass into big, you know, a stack like so big. And we'd feed it in very slowly. So you'd burn it, and as you fed it in, one stack, you know, would heat the floor for the day. So usually one pile of, you know, 10 pieces of wood would heat a floor for a day. Yes, I was, at the time I was doing all the fires, I was feeding stacks of this bamboo wood. But in my other hermitages, it was mostly ordinary wood that I fed into the fire. But it is a wonderful thing. You sit and you're watching this every day, you know, just watching this fire burn down, because you watch it, you know. Yes.
There seems to be a lot of emphasis within Zen Buddhism about this final spark, or then, you know,
the kensho, or the awakening. Yes.
The final clarity.
Yes.
As opposed to, if you actually do have any kind of, say, meditation development, you think of an incremental approach, like a drop of water in the bucket.
Yes. Yes. Cool. Yes.
So, how do you compare that kind of approach? What do you think about meditation as opposed to?
Actually, the spark is very rare, and the majority of practice is the drop in the bucket. There are two major schools. There's actually four schools in Zen, and I think you will find the same in the other schools of Buddhism. There is definitely in the Tibetan school. You have, and it depends on the capacity of the individuals. You have some individuals like the Buddha who have practiced, you know, tremendously in past lives, have probably had, you know, a number of major awakenings. So they may, you know, have had, be a Sotipatthana, even maybe a once returner, and they come back in this life and there's this meet a teacher and there's a spark and there's a flash, or they meet the Buddha and hear one sentence and they awaken. So that is really the sudden, what we say, sudden enlightenment, but it may be what they call gradual cultivation. So they may have a spark, you know, you meet a teacher, feel this great, you know, compassion arise, this great freedom arise, be very inspired, and you go to a temple, you know, for the next 50 years, and you start to cultivate, you start to learn about the Buddha, you start to put this into practice, do the practices, and develop concentration and insight. That is the instant awakening, but it's got a slow cultivation because it's not complete. It's only if somebody has, such as the Buddha, comes back and has this massive, you know, realization, then this is called a complete enlightenment. But generally, it's even going to be gradual. You'll come into a temple, for the majority of us, myself here, come into the temple, and, you know, you listen to the Dharma many, many times from many teachers and read many texts, and you have a little bit of, you know, there is a little refining going on. Yes. But I think the Zen stories are wake-up stories, really. You know, they're pick-me-ups, they wake up, they inspire you to, you know, get a move on, hopefully. Thank you. Now, someone down there. Yes.
I'm a bit curious about the opposite Vivek. You've got the Mahayana grade.
Yes. No, this is called a kasa, yes, because in the Buddha's time, you know, they wore the kasa. I actually have it normally a big full robe, which we use for ceremony, and I didn't know I was coming here to give a talk tonight, so I may have bought it, but normally in the Mahayana countries, they have, depending on the country and the culture, they have some development of the robes from the culture, such as this robe, and then you have the traditional Buddha's kasa, the outer robe of the Buddha. Because in cultures like Korea, Japan, China, it's very cold. These robes, you know, they didn't survive in this culture. Mm. So as Buddhism has developed in Tibet, you know, they developed with their cultural dress. China developed with its cultural dress, but all the traditions hold as representation of the traditional Buddha this kasa. It holds what is called the paddy fields, the rice fields, and it also holds the idea that the robes were made from rags and dyed with the ochre of the ground. Yes. Yes. Well, in some ways, the Zen, there is something like this in Zen tradition. You know, in my tradition in particular, there is many aspects in the practice very similar to Theravada. And then you have the Bodhisattva aspiration and the Mahayana aspect to that. Mm. Yes. Okay. Well, I think it's this time of night that we've all had a wonderful evening, so thank you very much for coming. And I hope you can take one or two small messages from this evening's talk and bring it into your life and reflect on it. And may it bring you great peace and happiness. Thank you very much.